This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
And a very warm welcome back to Solidarity Breakfast.
A left response to the major developments in capitalism.
What they trade in is not wheat. They trade in famine.
A little dose of revolutionary optimism.
I think it's really important to sort of express solidarity globally.
It really is a deal by corporations for corporations.
The union forever defending our rights. Down with the black leg.
If you think the ABC's left wing, don't listen to this program.
Solidarity Breakfast, 7:30 to 9 a.m. Saturdays, 3CR, 8:55 a.m. Streaming and 3CR digital, podcast or audio on demand. And of course, the website, solidaritybreakfast.org.au.
Solidarity forever!
Good morning, everybody. This is Annie and Tobiah.
Hey, good morning.
And we've now entered into the new phase of weather. It's now warm. How frightening is that?
Yeah, I know. It's feel alien without walking outside without a jumper now.
Yeah, exactly. We've got lots of news, of course. Do we want to start off with this week? The Israeli government approved the first phase of the Gaza ceasefire deal, commencing ceasefire as of 9 a.m. GMT on Friday, hours before the ceasefire came into effect. Israeli airstrike and shelling in Khan Yunis, a southern Gaza, and attacks east of Gaza City were reported, raising concerns about Israel's commitment to the terms of ceasefire. Israel has begun to withdraw IDF, or like I like to call them, the IOF troops, but will retain control of 58% of the Palestinian territory, according to the terms of the ceasefire deal. This includes all crossings in and out of Gaza. Following...
Yeah, and in the rogue state of the United States, following a US strike on alleged drug smuggling vessels in the Caribbean in September, statements from US military officials have increasingly suggested that strikes within Venezuela's territorial waters and land borders are being considered. Given President Donald Trump and Secretary of State Marco Rubio's claim that Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro is the leader of a designated narco-terrorist cartel, these statements raise concern that the U.S. military strikes may expand their focus far beyond cartels to the Venezuelan government.
Now, remembering, of course, that Venezuela is the biggest repository of oil in the entire world, interestingly enough.
And if you go on the Tricontinental Institute of Social Research, Vijay Prashad's think tank, you'll find so many resources on why Venezuela, the social situation in Venezuela is what it is. It is one of the most embargoed countries with outside of Cuba. This is the US still tightening its hands around Latin America.
And if we look at the US again and see it in the context of its ties to Australia, you will find that, that there was a very interesting report coming out of a Declassified Australia Special Investigation. That's an online newsletter, Declassification. Its barrels of nuclear waste material will be stored in an underground nuclear waste repository if a proposed salt mine south of Alice Springs in Central Australia proceeds. The proposal for the low-level nuclear waste dump comes as the federal government is seeking ways to manage and ultimately dispose of high-level nuclear waste from the nuclear reactors in the proposed AUKUS submarines, as well as from other defence-related nuclear and hazardous waste, including visiting US and UK nuclear-powered submarines and warships. The Tellus Chandler nuclear waste dump is proposed to be constructed within a salt formation on southern Arinta country, 15 kilometres from Aboriginal community Tikjakala and 120 kilometres south of Alice Springs. The Northern Territory Environmental Protection Authority assessment report for the Chandler Dump describes the project components as including construction of an underground salt mine at a depth of up to 860 metres, permanent hazardous waste disposal vaults within mined out salt caverns, temporary above-ground storage facilities for hazardous waste and associated infrastructure like haul roads, access roads and salt stockpiles, and the planned international nuclear waste dump, along with a separate 200-bed accommodation precinct and airport and upgraded roads, is to be located near the Aboriginal community. The company that's supposedly being put forward to do this is Armentum Holdings, which is based in Virginia, USA, and is one of the US's largest military contractors. The company employs 53,000 people across 80 countries and provides services as diverse as chemical and biological weapons decommissioning, US Army helicopter training, to running the Nevada bombing range and the Kennedy Space Center. You should go online and have a look at Declassified's report, because it goes into a rather disturbing case study of this company's role in running a nuclear dump in Mexico, which has had a variety of spillages and other safety problems, and also talks about things like declassifying high level nuclear waste so that it's bureaucratically changes its nature, but of course in real life doesn't.
Yeah, I mean, it's eerily reminiscent of the town in Western Australia called Wittenoom that was erased from the map. That's the town that used to manufacture blue asbestos and is now an absolute death zone with asbestos still poisoning the air.
And in fact, it's funny you should be talking about this, because there's actually a film that's going to be screened very shortly called Yugun, which is a country, and it's a statement from the people from there who are the person, the local custodian who's been leading the fight for the Western Australian government to actually clean up that site. He's recently died of mesothelioma. He wasn't working at that site. He was a ranger. But the fight continues, because apparently, I mean, if you look at the footage on this film, the site is just devastation. And all around it is this beautiful country. And to think that the government and the company, which was originally a Lang Hancock device, which he then sold on to a corporation that then took out millions and billions of dollars of worth out of it and then just left it there. And it's not just poisoned in a location, but of course the wind takes the poison all around the country and the world. It's just staggering that we allow this sort of thing to happen.
Well, and they want to keep doing it because, like you were saying, Annie, well, actually on the Australian maps, the Australian government maps, Wittenoom's erased. It doesn't exist for
them. No, that's right.
But like you were saying before, the reality actually still exists. There are asbestos fibres blowing in the wind through that entire region and poisoning communities thousands of kilometres away.
And they don't care.
Not interested.
Oh, there's a few jobs here. There's a lot of death. There's lots of death. If you want to go a bit closer, what about the data centres? Our Melbourne, for example, is becoming surrounded by a variety of data centres that are supposedly going to be leading the AI revolution. And
not the revolution that we need.
Not the revolution we need, yeah. So, for example, I was reading this really interesting thing. It was just an Instagram, but it says just a little of what is happening in the America and is coming our way with data centres already beginning to ring our suburbs. It starts off with Larry Page, $204.2 billion, Google, $2.84 trillion. That's where he gets his wealth from. Jeff Bezos is worth $232.5 billion, Amazon $2.3 trillion, Sam Altman $2.8 billion, OpenAI $500 billion, Bill Gates $105 billion personal wealth, Microsoft, where it comes from, $3.9 trillion. And the person who put this up says, can someone please explain why on earth we're paying the power and water bills of their data centres? Electricity costs are up 267% in areas where AI data centres are located. Sam Altman's AI empire is projected to use as much power as New York City and San Diego combined. Meanwhile, 37 states passed legislation granting sales tax exemption for data centres. Big tech gets tax breaks, you get the bill.
And when we're just coming up to the end of the roundup for the news, I mean, there's so much to report on. It never seems like we have quite enough time. I'll just read you a couple of excerpts from Nora Barrows-Friedman from the Electronic Intifada's report on the ceasefire. And then I have a couple of other little bits to paint a picture of what Gaza and what Palestine was like before October 7th. But I'll start quoting Nora Barrows-Friedman. Palestinians on the ground in Gaza City say that since the ceasefire talks in Egypt began earlier this week, Israel only continued to escalate its attacks. The Gaza government media office stated on Wednesday that in the 4 days since the announcement of a potential truce, Israel carried out 271 separate attacks, killing approximately 126 people, 80 of whom were killed in Gaza City. Our longtime contributor Mohammed Assad uploaded images and videos after the Israeli army destroyed his home early this week on October 7th in Gaza City, forcing his family to seek shelter once again. His home was damaged in previous attacks, and his family worked to clean it up and repair it, but this week it was completely razed to the ground. He's quoted saying, "Our dreams turned into a mirage," he said. The Gaza government media office released updated statistics on the 2 years of genocide, including figures on the destruction of homes, livelihood, health, and infrastructure across Gaza. Among the data set was an estimate that Israel had dropped more than 200,000 tons of explosive on Gaza since October 2023. More than 835 mosques were completely destroyed, the media office added, and at least 180 others were damaged. While 3 churches were damaged in bombings, more than half of all Gaza's 60 cemeteries have been targeted as well, 14 of which have been completely destroyed and 18 which have been partially destroyed.
Not dead enough.
No, not quite. The media office estimates that nearly 80,000 Palestinians have been killed or are still missing since the beginning of the genocide, 67,000 of whom were brought to hospitals and recorded as killed by the health ministry. Obviously, that tells you what the recording practices are like that are happening under these conditions and how low these estimates actually are. Nearly 10,000 people are still missing and still buried under the rubble, and approximately 20,000 children have been killed. Among the dead are 1,015 infants under a year old. Approximately 460 Palestinians have died from starvation, and nearly 170,000 have been injured, including 19,000 who will need long-term rehabilitation. Around 4,800 people have had their limbs amputated, nearly a fifth of them children. Israeli armored vehicles packed with explosive have continued to destroy buildings and entire city blocks around Gaza City, particularly in the Sabra neighborhood, where the video from journalist Ahmed Al-Saifi was filmed on Wednesday. That video you can go see on the Electronic Intifada website. It's really important that you go watch that. Al Jazeera's Hani Mahmoud reported on the 8th of October that Israeli forces were scaling up attacks aimed at the systemic destruction of the city's remaining infrastructure, flattening what is left of residential buildings, public facilities, and entire neighborhoods. He's quoted saying the army is reportedly using remote-controlled explosive robots alongside air attacks and heavy military to heavy artillery to demolish densely built areas. Fighter jets have targeted wide boulevards and high-rise city blocks in the city centre, leaving large sections of Gaza City reduced to rubble. Despite talk of a potential agreement, many in Gaza believe the Israeli military is rushing to complete the destruction before any truce takes effect. On the ground, people describe what feels like the final stages of destruction, an effort to render Gaza uninhabitable by erasing all means of life. On the 3rd of October, reporter Hamza Kurek spoke to a grandmother who survived an Israeli attack on tent shelters at the Gaza port, sitting on the floor next to a metal bed with no mattress, where two small children lay unconscious. She asked, "What did children do to deserve this? Three children and their mother, who was my daughter, and my sister, over 15 people were killed in this strike. What did they do?" She said that they were displaced from Jabalia in northern Gaza and the Israeli army targeted their tent. Now, I'll just quickly pass to this. There's more of that report that you can find on the Electronic Intifada website, and I'd encourage you to go. But I'll just read you. This is a report from the 19th of September, 2023, from Save the Children Australia. 2023 marks deadliest year on record for children in the occupied West Bank.
Just remembering, this is 2023. This is
a while ago. At least 38 Palestinian children have been killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank so far in 2023, making it the deadliest year since records began, said Save the Children. This horrific record was reached this month after the death of two 16-year-old boys on two separate occasions. On average, it equates to more than one Palestinian child per week. At least six Israeli children have also been killed this year. As the second consecutive year for records of number of child fatalities in the West Bank, this highlights the worsening situation for children's safety across the occupied Palestinian territory. A Palestinian child interviewed by Save the Children last year was one of the children killed this month. His words are a haunting reminder of the fears Palestinian children face on a regular basis, and his death drives home the reality of those at risk. Yusuf said, "My dream is to be able to look up at anything on my way to school, like birds and greenery. I want to see the things I always imagine. I don't want to smell gas or see soldiers everywhere. I don't want to be scared to go outside. I don't want my mother to be scared that I might get hurt or roam the streets looking for me, fearing I was hurt by Israeli soldiers." And then I'll just skim through a couple of the quotes. Amina, a 15-year-old girl who experienced the Jenin military operation, said, "Every once in a while I sit alone in the room and start crying. I cry about everything that happened to us. I dream every day of what happened. I don't sleep until dawn and until I make sure they're not coming back for us. My daughters are not the same. My 7-year-old refuses to leave the house alone now. And once the girl hears that the soldiers are coming into the camp, they start crying and leave." And I'll take you back even further in this terrible book that I'm reading that has actually some good quotes in it. But this is a PLO soldier in the early 2000s talking about the situation. He says, the difficulty is that they are right outside and they have guns. We live under occupation and have only our stones. We know that the stone doesn't do anything, but we're looking beyond the stone to be able to say to the outside world what we want. For now, the stone speaks for us. When the Zionists wrong us, such as the time I saw them poking an old man with sticks to make him sing, they give us the courage to do more back at them. What should I do? I have only stones. When I hear their politicians speak up about us, about getting rid of the Arabs and so on, what should I do? Should I wait 100 years for my rights? What would you do if you had lived under occupation for 40 years?
I'm exhausted. Last night I couldn't sleep, but when I did I could hear bombs in my dreams. Nightmare situation, how could they be so evil? Making martyrs out of children and innocent people. We expect the bombs, not knowing where next. Huddle in the corner of my room, trying to protect my little brother as the building shakes like it's possessed, but nothing stronger than the will of the oppressed. I bomb back with my lyrics and rhymes, living the times, trying to break the Palestinian minds. What's hiding in the clouds hanging over my head? My dad risks his life outside to buy bread. The fourth war in my 12th year. At this stage I'm numb, though I haven't feel scared. There's nothing I can do in this case to stay safe. I'm brave, even though this house could be in my grave. I want freedom for the population. 2 million prisoners living in this location, shouting at the wall, but nothing is ever changing. That's life under an occupation. I want freedom for the population. 2 million prisoners living in this location, shouting at the wall, but nothing is ever changing. That's life under an occupation. Mothers mourn, fighting with grief. White sheets covered by his death, lie on the streets. Buildings turn to ash, but my mind is made of steel. So it doesn't take much for me to heal. Won't lose the will to live or lose our minds. My auntie lost her home, so she lost her life. But she is still alive, but traumatized by the bombs that flew in and dropped that night. My sister couldn't sleep, tried to stop her cries. I said it was fireworks, I was telling her lies. Where's the compassion? This is heartless. It's like they want us all living in darkness, cutting off water and electricity for hours. They're knocking towers, but that's not knocking the power that I have in my pen. When I'm writing, I'm unstoppable. The microphone is the only escape possible, 'cause that's the way that I can speak my mind. I wonder how does the fighter pilot sleep at night, knowing he can turn the city upside down all of a sudden, slaughtering families with the push of a button. I want freedom for the population. 2 million prisoners living in this location, shouting at the wall, but nothing is ever changing. That's life under an occupation. I want freedom for the population. 2 million prisoners living in this location, shouting at the wall, but nothing is ever changing. That's life under an occupation.
3CR Community Radio, giving voice to the community since 1976.
And that was MC Abdul shouting at the wall. That song was released 4 years ago. And you can see he's this young kid that's rapping in amongst the rubble, just giving you an idea of what life was like before October 7th. And now, thanks to Comrade Vivian Langford up in Sydney, we'll hear a bit at the Sydney Palestine vigil that was held last Sunday. We'll hear from Nessa
Turnbull. It's on from Monday.
Monday. My apologies. But you can hear more.
And it was at the Sydney Town Hall.
Yeah, you can hear more of Vivian Langford on the Climate Action Show.
5 o'clock on Mondays.
We'll hear from Nessa Turnbull Roberts first, and then if we have time, Peter Slezak.
Jingiwala Nungali Drugan Drugan Nungali Banji language Buwaibu Gurna. Gurna to the Gara, Nanagara leaves that you're all standing under, the healing leaves. These leaves are holding, these trees are holding, they're quite young, but they're bringing us together in this moment, providing far greater protection than any form of authoritarian system that is actually around us. The same authoritarian system that's likely to try and stop the national march next week, which actually requires us to keep our ongoing strength and struggle and fight for Palestine. My name is Vanessa Turnbull Roberts, and I'm a proud Bundjalung Widjibal Waiyibal woman, and I'm honoured to be invited to come and speak and share a few words here with you all this evening. Thank you to the organisers, thank you to the people that are doing so much work behind the scenes, and thank you to the people. Whilst we know these numbers are smaller than our usual weekly meetups or gatherings or coming together, that the fact that we are being consistent and compassionate and not being silent and demanding that there is an end to the genocide that we are seeing. Last week I had the privilege to speak on a panel, and on the panel we spoke about the similarities and the struggles between First Nations people here in so-called Australia and the ongoing occupation that is going on in Palestine. What we know when we talk about colonization and the violence in Palestine and what's going here is that Australia does it here so well to our children and young people, except it does it so systematically that often we can be blind to the injustice that we are seeing. But one of the tools that Palestine and Palestinians are being subject to is the main tool that First Nations people here, Indigenous people in the Philippines, Rohingya, Congo, Indigenous people across the world being subject to things such as incarceration, because incarceration is the greatest tool that can be used to silence our people. And that's what we're seeing used here, and we're seeing it in the National Trump Peace Agreement, which is not a peace agreement. I won't comment too much on that because I also acknowledge I'm not Palestinian, it's not my place, and that is up to the people directly impacted. But what makes me sick is that it's four white supremacists that want to hold the power over the negotiating process of what is not peace. Shame. There can never be peace when you're contemplating whether you release 1,500 people from a prison. 1,500 people where we know more than half those people are children and young people. Shame. Shame on not letting food go to Palestine. Shame on committing a genocide. Shame on shooting and killing young people. And shame on a disproportionate response that sees children throw a piece of paper and the Israeli occupation respond with strikes, bombs, and violence funded by this country, funded by the USA, and funded by the white supremacy that we see flow so well and smoothly. Shame! Our justice is intertwined with the Palestinian fight. Our people make up more than half the prison population here in so-called Australia. Shame! Until Palestine is free, which we know is the moral litmus test for all of us, we know we are in a moment right now. We heard my beautiful Aunty Barb give a precious welcome to country, talking about the peace and the love of Palestine. We heard her strength. We heard that she allowed us and welcomed us here in this country, on this place. And we know for a fact that what is going on in Palestine is going on here in so-called Australia. And we all have a duty. When we think of the strength and we think of the struggle and we think of everybody coming together, we know for a fact that the tolls are changing. We know for a fact that the power is laying in the hands of the people. We know for a fact that every time we come together, whether it's a small amount, a large amount, or a medium, every time we come together, we are showing where we stand when it comes to making sure we see sanctions on Israel. Whether you're funding a nail, whether you're funding a large piece of a weapon, if you are participating, you are actively complicit in the violence. Shame. So I just wanted to acknowledge everybody coming out here tonight, acknowledge my beautiful Aunty Barb. I don't know where she's gone off. I love you, Aunty Barb, with all my heart, the whole thing. Yeah. And we are at a vigil, and I just wanted to acknowledge what vigils mean, in particular around sorry business, because in our culture, sorry business is a very important thing. And I know for a fact that if we were actually to undertake sorry business for every single life that has been lost in Palestine, well, we would need to be here for over a year. We would actually need to be here for over 2 years, over 3 years, because we know for a fact that this did not start on October 7th. We know for a fact that we are here for far more greater reasons, where we know the genocide against Palestine has been happening for far too long, except now the resistance is loud, now the love is loud, now the compassion is loud, now for a fight for humanity and to say, actually, let's look at Palestine, let's look at the strength, because when Palestine is free, we know that we will all be free, because this has brought the world together, the world. I think of Truganini, I think of Brengaroo, I think of Aunty Barb, I think of my Uncle Dean, my Auntie Kalita, I think of my mother, my father, the people that have been fighting, resisting in their own ways in a place that doesn't say they don't belong. My Nan was a slave on her own land. My father was considered less human for half his life. And then he watched his own daughter be taken, because that's the way systematic violence works. If you can bring separation, if you can enact disconnection, then you can not only physically hurt me, but you can mentally see the implications of what it does to a whole community and a whole village. And that is one of the tools and main tools that we're seeing used by Israel. They're killing children intentionally. They're separating the kids. They're incarcerating young people, because we know the power and the love is often led by the young. The young hold that power, because we say to our elders and our community members, Auntie, uncle, I've got this. I'll lead. But then we see a response of separation and disconnection. And we know what that does to families, and we know what that does to communities. Here in this country, we have a prime example of removal, separation, incarceration that works well. So all I say is I acknowledge all the lives that we have lost post October 7th, but I know for a fact there are so many lives prior to October 7th that we need to honour, that we need to hold tight, and that we need to have in our thoughts here tonight. Sorry, business matters. Keeping Palestine, keeping all countries and First Nations people across the world who are facing an ongoing genocide matters. None of us are free until we are all free, so thank you so much for your time. Guruga, have a beautiful night where you can, and just hold each other. Thank you.
What's taking place in Palestine is horrendous.
Here are some ways that you can keep yourself informed and involved.
Listen in to Palestine Remembered every Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. or listen to the podcast.
Join the APAN mailing list at apan.org.au for updates, news about actions you can get involved in, and where you can donate to provide humanitarian assistance.
Listen to other news and current affairs programs on 3CR that also cover Palestine.
The oppression of the Palestinian people has been going on for 75 years. It has to stop. You can be part of making that happen by staying informed and active.
APAN is a proud supporter of 3CR.
On the 12th of October, we will be marching and commemorating 2 years of genocide, 2 years of resistance, and 2 years of steadfastness. The Palestinian people here in Naam and the community will be marching together. We invite you all to join us and stand side by side to call for justice for the Palestinian people in Gaza, in Jerusalem, in Nablus, in Nafa, and in all the cities. We have been marching for the last 103 weeks back to back, calling for justice for Palestine and calling to sanction Israel. It is our duty to stand together with the oppressed. Join us on Sunday, 12th of October at the State Library, 12 o'clock. And remember, always, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free.
And we're going to go down to the Peter Norman commemoration that was held on the 9th of October. That's Friday. And, of course, Peter Norman, oh, no, that was Thursday. That's right. It was a terribly windy day. And I have to apologise to all the people there. I only caught some of the recording because there was a bit of operator error, I'd have to say. But this is Joe, Dr. Joe is out. We're outside the, we're down at Albert Park because there's actually a statue of Peter Norman. And Joe describes why it's so important for us all to be commemorating Peter Norman Day on the 9th of October. Go for it. We're outside the Lakeside Stadium Gate 1, but and right in front of us is the wonderful statue of Peter Norman. Isn't it wonderful that there is a statue of Peter Norman?
Yeah, what is actually wonderful is the actual, all the badges are there.
Yeah.
The Project for Human Rights, which is what he stood for, is the prominent badge. Above his Australian Olympic blazer pocket. And this is what this is all about. Now, most people, those of us who are old enough, will remember 68. 1968 was a pivotal moment in Western history.
Terrible Olympics as well.
Well, that's right. 200 Mexican students were slaughtered the day before the opening of the Olympics by the Mexican Armed Forces, something which hasn't been acknowledged even now, 67 years later. That's
disgraceful.
Yeah. And you had the USA was burning because of race riots, the assassination of Martin Luther King. You had the French student riots across Europe, not just France. You had the Russian invasion or the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia. So it was a period of turmoil. Young people were trying to break out of the dichotomy between the authoritarian communism and authoritarian or corporate capitalism. They were looking for a way forward, and it was described as generally as the new left movement. Now, Peter Norman was just an ordinary bloke, ran fast. He
ran fast.
Yeah, he ran fast, you know. He got chosen for the 68 Olympics. He turns up, wide-eyed boy, you know, Salvation Army lad. You know, he's wandering the streets. He does his race, can't believe it. He comes second. His coach, Neville Stilter, is watching the race on black and white TV back in Melbourne because he wasn't invited, obviously, not like today. And, you know, and he's wandering around and this black bloke beats him and there's other black blokes, Afro-American, you know, there's Ferd and he's having a chat with him. And they say to him, oh, what's your name? He said, Peter Norman. He said, oh. And they said to him, do you believe in God? Then they said, do you believe in human rights? Been a Salvation Army lad? He said, yeah, yeah. And he says, do you know about the project for human rights, the Olympic project for human rights? And he said, no. Well, he said, look, he said, Afro-American athletes created this organisation called the Olympic Project for Human Rights for Olympic athletes, or, you know, you don't have to be Afro-American, you can be anybody to join. And we're about promoting equality amongst all people. We're about promoting equality. They said this is not about a black power struggle. And if you read Tommy Smith's books, he will say over and over again, this was about human rights, not just a black power struggle. So he said, oh, yeah, not thinking much about it. And they gave him a badge. And, you know, the next day there comes the medal, that afternoon, I'm not sure, there's the medal ceremony and they're wandering down. They told him they were going to wear black gloves and give, you know,
the salute.
And Johnny Carlos and Tommy Smith and Peter Norman are walking down to the dais. And Carlos says to Smith, did you bring the glove? Did you bring your gloves? He said, yeah. And Smith says to Carlos, did you bring your gloves? He said, no, I forgot. So Peter Norman said, and this is a true story, why don't you each wear a glove, all right? You know, one on the left hand, one on the right hand, okay? And I'll wear the badge. So there they are, they're standing on the dais. You know, they give their salute. All hell breaks loose. This is 68. White Australia policy in Australia, apartheid in South Africa, the anti-apartheid struggle, race riots, you know, convulsion in America.
Oh, and Olympics and sports aren't political.
No, they're not political, never political. Ask the Soviet Union, though, and the German athletes and the steroids they got injected with. Never political. So, and all of a sudden, all hell breaks loose. Tommy and Carlos are deported back to the States. They're stripped of their medals. They're ostracised. Peter Norman comes back to Australia. And Mr. Patching, who was the Australian Olympic president, goes bananas. The Australian media can't believe that this whippersnapper, you know, has shamed the country. We'll see you on the 24th. Yeah. He's shamed the country. And he was ostracised, pushed around. You know, his marriage broke down, remarried, had more children, you know, and died in 2006 in Coburg, right? Because that's where he lived. He lived in Coburg. That's where he was part of the Coburg Athletics Club. So when he died, Tommy Smith and John Carlos turned up at his funeral in 2006 and they gave the eulogies. And they declared on behalf of the American Track and Field Association that the 9th of October, the day of his funeral, not the day of his death, but the day of his funeral, will be recognised as Peter Norman's Day, Human Rights Day, because of the stand he stood. Because the most important thing to remember is he uttered some very important words when he spoke to them. He said to them, I will stand with you. And that's the story. Each and every one of us can be Peter Norman. Each and every one of us, every day of our existence, we see things, we hear things that we are unhappy with.
In fact, they've got a statue, haven't they?
Yeah.
Where we've got the two first and third, and a space left for other people to stand on, right?
That's right. In the US, I'm not sure what city, but there is. And they asked Peter Norman, because he was alive, and he said, don't you feel insulted? And he said, no. He said, this is what it's all about. You know, yeah. I will stand with you. It means each and every one of you can stand in that statue, stand in the middle of Carlos and Smith, have your photograph taken, and you can do what I did. But there were consequences. I won't go through all of them, but what I found fascinating...
They were very vicious, weren't they?
They were vicious. I'll give you an example. you know, this year is the 25th anniversary of the Sydney Olympics. We are told the world's greatest Olympics since the Greeks, all right? Okay, guess who wasn't invited to the official ceremony? Peter Norman. Now, when the American Track and Field Association realised he hadn't been invited, they invited him into their quarters at the Olympic Village and he was their guest for the 2 weeks. Isn't that extraordinary?
Yeah, yeah.
That is extraordinary. That,
and, had long memories.
And even now, 38 and 25, 53, yeah. Whatever, 57, 57 years later, 57 years later, you get a little group of people, and that's important that we remember, but there are no official ceremonies in this country. There's no politician gets up and speaks about Peter Norman. There's no television programs. There's nothing on the radio. It's as if in a city of 5.5 million people, in a country of 27 million people, what he did is irrelevant. And I think that highlights how far we need to go. So if you are listening to this, just remember, midday, 9th of October, have a Peter Norman Day celebration. You don't have to come to Lakeside Oval. You can organise it in your town, in your city, in your school, in your community, in your nursing home. And pay some respect, not just to the man, but what he stood for.
Thanks, Jared.
So I was an athlete in my teenage years. I played basketball, athletics and football. When I was about 15, I quit playing football just due to a few too many instances of racism. That same year, I actually had this image in my high school journal. And later on that year, I was nominated for the Pierre de Coubertin Award who was the founder of the modern day Olympics. And yeah, so I went to this presentation to receive this award. And as far as I knew, this a gentleman who came up to me was the president of this committee. He kind of singled me out and was genuinely interested to know who I was. And he said that he was really proud of me in front of my high school principal, who was my biggest fan. And then many years later, I went and watched the Salute documentary by Matt Norman. And then I was trying to think, where do I know this face from? Then I realized it was Peter Norman who presented me this award. And yeah, from there, I just really understanding his story from there, it really stuck with me. And just kind of like, it just kind of revamped my idea of like human compassion, and especially in times of turmoil like 1968. So many years later, I think it probably would have been about 10 or so years later, I realized that I came across the same way you guys did, seeing that Peter Norman Day was being celebrated. I came late to the celebration and just decided to give a speech on the spot and just kind of give my understanding of his legacy. Little did I know that I was giving a speech in front of his family, and that's how I came to be a part of the Peter Norman Commemoration Committee. And Peter Norman, in my eyes, is the greatest white Australian who's ever lived, and I think that we should all be doing more to commemorate him. That like there should be flocks of people here, yeah. And As Joe said, it's not going to come from the top down. It comes from people like us. And yeah, we just got to, I think we should all, everyone here should join the committee, and we should all just, if we all invite 10 people each next year, then we can get this moving and then just make it exponential from there.
This is a rapacious expansion of privatisation, which is going to change the face of the city that we live in.
It's not share, it's not making the housing crisis go away. It's really about the big end of town. It's a shame job.
It's a transfer. It's a theft of public wealth, which is going to worsen the housing crisis.
The government is giving public land to private developers. Why would you do that? Why would you give all these assets over to the biggest bully in town?
We're looking down the future that we don't know what's going to happen. Where are we going to get moved to? Dandenong? Or away from our communities and away from the services that we need.
This is a line in the sand for not only the public housing tenants, but for a Victorian society.
3CR. A week solidarity bricky team listener, when peace, 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 the most momentous moment in all human history ever, ever. US of the UN of the US of the world, big supremo Donald Trump, or the poor understated. And given 77 years of history of slaughter, destruction, genocide and starvation, no one would for a moment think the peace, peace, peace is anything but permanent. With the Palestinian non-land, non-people disarming as part of the plan, and therefore, presumably, Zion will also disarm, get rid of its massive arsenal of trained killer merchandise, including the parts of the killer jets that Trubler was he doesn't supply because it only supplies them to the merchants of death. And Zion will provide opportunities for the non-land, non-people it hasn't already slaughtered, destroyed, genocided and starved to leave this real estate Riviera of the Middle East opportunity. Not that Donald's son-in-law, Jared Cash, Cash, Cash and more Kashner, is there for any other purpose than his dedication to peace, peace, peace and what's best for the non-land, non-people. And as well as the non-land, non-people being cleared out, Zion will withdraw to an agreed-upon line. My goodness, that's definitive, isn't it? And will withdraw from the non-land it occupies altogether when the time is right. Also, so specific and definitive. And we know Zion has a long record of abiding by peace deals, or would, if the evil people it slaughters weren't so evil that they abide by the agreements. So it's all looking positive. And anyway, the peace, peace, peace deal, everything with Donald is a deal, is so generous it offers up former Her Most Gracious Majesty's home country Big Suprema and warmonger Tiny Blyer and Donald himself to govern the non-land. Donald modestly boasted success, ending with, "Blessed be the peacemakers," in huge capitals. Donald, a religious man devoted to the one true God, Donald. The huge capitals making it easier for the Nobel Committee not to miss it. Not that he's desperately chasing the Peace Prize for personal reasons. No, no, no. If he doesn't receive it, it will be an insult to the US of, he said. The biggest insult ever, ever. He's so selfless, isn't he? Peace, peace, peace was preceded by October 7 with outrage among Zion supporters, including Big Supremo Anthony Albanese and the Minister for Going Overseas all the time and being a perfectly good little prefect, Penny Left Wing, and of course, naturally, Coalition Supremo and would-be Big Supremo Sussan, Lees and Dregs and all her lot, that non-land, non-people supporters, therefore anti-Semites, would so disrespect the day, be so sacrilegious that they would graffiti cruelly and hold rallies, commemorating the at least 67,000 and some say more like 100,000 slaughtered non-land, non-people. The outrage expressed by Anthony, it was not a day for demonstrations, it deserved decent human behaviour, as he expressed his support for Zion and the slaughterers, while a Zion spokesperson said those demonstrating were supporters of murder, when they, poor disillusioned souls, thought they were protesting against murder, while State Supremo Jacinta, alien to non-land, non-people, said protesters were deeply disrespectful of the slaughterers. Wonder how long it will be before Zion concocts an excuse to resume the slaughter, destruction, genocide and starvation, laying the blame on evil Hamas and the evil non-land, non-people. Watching the Palestinians celebrating the hiatus in the slaughter amid the ruins, we can but hope it does last, but history would tell us otherwise, particularly as Donald and his son-in-law have their eyes on the real estate along with Benjamin. Anthony and Penny and the Minister for Being Offensive and Train Killing Richard Malls the bad guys, he of the giant mind, also earned top marks for bravery and principle as a number of Trubler Aussies were being held hostage under torturous conditions by Zion, pleading with Zion to allow consular access when just maybe a condemnation of illegal piracy wouldn't have hurt. That's probably a tautology. Piracy on the open seas. Peace campaigners attempting to provide humanitarian aid. And the illegal blockade of Gaza's legal right to its own waters, of which Zion has absolutely no right. Oh, sorry, forgot. Trubler was he knows that Zion and the US of have a right to do as it they wish. Not a word of condemnation, other than condemning those who protest over Zion's gross illegality. Still, we're sure they'd be consistent. Like, say, if evil China seized true blue Aussies off the high seas, obviously they wouldn't loudly and righteously scream condemnation. Back here, we learned how unreasonable our own terra nullius non-land non-people can be. Case up in Northern True Blue Aussie, which is building a commendable record of support for non-land non-people, like a racist, a police force locking up 10-year-old kids or killing brain-damaged shoplifters, providing terrified white potential victims of out-of-control crime with their very own capsicum spray. Commendable support. This case, car driver Jake Danby, 24, real name, struck two terra nullius people, killing one, injuring the other, and subsequently referred to them with a string of racist rants, including the N-word, leading the court to rule he clearly displayed remorse. The mind boggles at what he'd have to rant not to show remorse. Displayed remorse and sentenced him to a crippling community corrections order, prompting Katie Kiss, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Island Commissioner, how's this for showing no respect for the law, to claim this was systemic racial discrimination on full display. Aboriginal lives are not protected by the state. There is no justice in this outcome. Oh, and just because Danby has a family connection to the Northern Territory, Northern True Blue Aussie Attorney General, and had boasted he would never see the inside of a prison cell, true to form, the non-land non-people are also carrying on about that, despite the government assuring us there was no conflict of interest. Just another day in the life and deaths of terra nullius non-land non-people. Even the Productivity Commission, hardly a bastion of commie economic nonsense, indeed more a repository of neoliberal common sense, has proposed a cash flow tax of 5% affecting the most profitable corporates based on their super profits, and thank goodness for the most profitable corporates and the True Blue Aussie Business Profits Council that we are aware how unfounded, how damaging, how downright silly is this proposal. We need to close down this conversation as quickly as possible, the Profits Council told Anthony Albanese at its annual meeting a couple of weeks ago, and this week the Profits Council Supremo Brand Blockhead explained why. It would shrink the economy, increase compliance costs, have a negative impact on competitiveness, prevent investment. Disaster. What was the Productivity Commission thinking of? Brand put it so succinctly. We can't pay tax and invest, he clarified. And of course, the compliance costs would be the costs of tax lawyers and accountants to ensure they meet their legal tax obligations by not paying the 5%. Interesting, isn't it, how they keep coming up with new ways for those who don't pay tax not to pay tax? One of the great international corporate consultants, Deloitte, the shareholders, consulted by the Department of Criminalizing Dole Bludgers, from whom Deloitte, they has extracted a mere $25 million in recent times, consulted on ways to criminalize dole bludgers, earned its exorbitant fee by utilizing AI. The report accepted by the department, until a vigilant Sydney academic, Dr. Chris Rudge, noticed a few little problems, like at least 14 references that simply didn't exist, and a quote from a judge in a robo-debt case that also doesn't exist, the quote that is. Its quoted paragraph numbers don't exist either, and anyway, they also managed to get her honour's name wrong. Deloitte says, as the proverbial hit the fan, it may consider paying back a bit of the exorbitant fee. Perhaps it could use AI to determine how much, or more correctly, how little. While some observers, although not yet the department or the government, reckon they should refund the lot 100%. How unfair! It wasn't their fault. It was AI that stuffed it up. Like poor telecommunications, or more often not telecommunications corporate, copped us no, no, no. We've now discovered it was blameless in the latest not telecommunicating incident. It sent two emails to the wrong address. An expert telecommunications business can't be blamed for that. Anyway, the coalition knows where the blame lies. It was the government's fault. Hasn't quite explained why or how, but we can take their word for it. Sussin and the team know. mentioned last week, Cop Does No 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 is one of the numerous huge caring businesses meeting their legal tax obligations by paying not 1 cent, bringing us to this corporate welfare, 600 mil of corporate welfare, handed to international pollution giant Glen Rotten to the core, after it threatened to close its Mount Isa smelter. Glen Rotten to needs the handout desperately, as its massively profitable 13 Trubler Aussies, beautiful but don't be afraid of it coal mines and copper, lead, zinc, nickel and cobalt mines, revenues of 41.9 billion real figure. Thank goodness we're handing them 600 mil from those who can't avoid their legal tax obligations, as the parent company, Glen Rotten 2 Holdings, paid, we guessed it, not 1 cent in tax. In the apropos of nothing department, headline reporting the death of author Gilly Cooper. Blockbuster author Gilly Cooper dies suddenly. And I thought, not all that suddenly. It took 88 years. Finally, another exciting benefit of the onomatopoeic Forker strain killer deal. A mob called CDC Data Centers plans data centers in Western Trubler Aussie to exploit the great opportunities offered by Forker's. Train killing, coal, 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 gas, 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 win, win, win. And all that water extracted from, oh, they'll work it out. Good morning.
And you're back with Annie Entebier on the Solidarity Breakfast on 3CR, your community radio station. And thanks very much, Kevin.
Good morning to you.
Yeah. And we're going to go on to a piece from the Fertilla that shut down Pine Gap on Thursday, the spy base. It's Carmen speaking to Joe's making a big appearance on our program today. Joe and Pat from Talk Back With Attitude, they gave us a call, and this is a preliminary to having a yarn with someone who can tell us what actually happened.
Morning, Carmen.
Good morning.
How are you?
We're really good here.
Tell us where you are exactly for listeners.
We are on Hutt Road, which is the road into the Pine Gap US military surveillance spy base. Mm-hmm. Near Alice Springs, about 20 k's south of Alice Springs, and we've blocked down the road to intervene in Pine Gap's participation in the genocide against Gazans and Palestinians at the hands of the Israeli occupying forces. This is our third blockade, which has shut down the road.
You're right.
And we're back again. And we're going to hold it down for as long as we can.
Right. Could you explain Pine Gap's role for us?
Yeah. So Pine Gap collects surveillance data from a large section of the world. They've got three enormous Orion satellites. And at the moment, their tasking priorities are over the Middle East, over the Swana region, over Palestine. And it's a joint Australian-US military spy base. So what happens is they collect the data from those satellites, and those satellites are targeting all Gazans, all Palestinians, not just military or combatants. It's all civilians. They're targeting all civilians. They're getting all of that data. They're collecting it. They're handing it to the U.S. military, who's handing it to the Israeli occupying forces, and they're using that to target journalists, their families, hospitals, schools, families, children, absolutely everyone there, and they're raising the ground. And Australia is an active aggressor in that genocide through this base. And also, of course, we know that we're exporting weapons and you know, sending diplomatic support and all that sort of stuff as well. But for us here who live in this town, this is the intervention that's within our reach. And and our demands are to close the base, to end the genocide, land back to the traditional owners of the land that Pine Gap is built on, and we want prosecution for war criminals and any Australian that is participating in this genocide. And we're asking the Attorney General to enact that that investigation and immediately close down the base.
Now, what do you expect is going to happen to you there at the blockade?
Well, it's very peaceful at the moment, actually. They're sort of used to us now. So what happens is we block down the road.
Right.
They turn all their workers away. There's about workers at this base, 400 US and 400 Australian.
Mm-hmm.
And they turn them away for the day. And they know that they've got to wait for the fireys to come down to cut us out of the barrel here. So we're sitting calmly here, and they'll probably try to arrest a couple of people later for loitering.
How many are locked down?
Two people are locked on, and then there's two boats full of people as well, either side of the barrel.
Right.
Okay. Chocolate block.
Well, we wish you all the best, don't we, Pat?
We certainly do.
And
would you like to talk to any of the people on the barrel?
Well,
love to. Yeah.
If they would like to, yes.
Sure. Who would like to go first?
Yeah, speak to both of us. We're both here.
Give us your name. My name's Pat and Joe. We're both listening to you.
Okay. Hi, Pat. Hi, Joe. This is Yule, and I'm locked onto the barrel with
Jorgen.
Hello.
You don't sound that young to me. You should be a nursing home, shouldn't you? Not doing what you're doing.
Say that again.
I said you don't sound that young to me. You should be, you know, knitting or something, shouldn't you?
Knitting or in a nursing home, he said. Not doing that.
There were people here who were protesting this road in the 80s.
Oh, I remember you, Mum. I was down there in the 80s. Yeah, you can tell. Maybe it was maybe I recognised the voice. So how long have you been locked on for?
Going on 4 hours now, I think.
Right.
And nobody's come to remove you?
No, we could have just been wandering around all this time.
Right.
There are police here. There's Australian Federal Police and local police, and they've asked us to move, but we're not moving.
Right. Did you ask them for a parasol? It'd be hot work in the barrel. It would be.
Well,
it's got to be in the 30s or 40s, hasn't it?
It was 40 yesterday. It was brutal.
Whoa.
And today we've got a lovely little breeze. All of our flags are flying.
Right. What flags have you got flying?
We've got the Aboriginal flag, and we've got some Palestinian flags, and we've got a whole bunch of banners.
Right. And what's on the banners?
There's one that says Free Palestine, End the Genocide, Close Pine Gap.
Mm-hmm.
Got another one that says Close Pine Gap Now, Resist Colonial and Imperial Violence.
Liberation of
Right.
And we've got Disarm the War Machines, Land Back.
Right.
We've got one specifically about Palestinian journalists.
All right. Look,
we've started up a little banner factory on the side.
Oh, yeah. You might as well do something with the time. you got to be productive out there. Yeah.
Well, it'd be much more exciting there than being in a nursing home.
Well, I don't know. It depends. It depends whether you fall out of bed or not. But that's a different story.
I don't think he's got a bed out there.
That's where we're going.
He's laying on the desert.
Did you bring a cushion? That's what I want to know.
What?
We got a rug.
You got a rug. All right.
Oh, that's good.
These are 1980s, you know, toughies. This is what they are.
We're going to leave it there, and we've got Jorgen on the line, and he's going to tell us what actually happened after that conversation. G'day, Jorgen. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well.
Yeah, and can you tell us...
Thanks for taking the time to wake up so early. I know we're an hour and a half in front, I think.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, good on you. Tell us what happened ultimately with your flotilla shuts down Pine Gap.
Sure. So I guess we were speaking to you at about 8:30 a.m. or so, the recording that you just heard, and I reckon it was about 11 that the firefighters eventually arrived, the emergency services arrived, and they went off and consulted with the police. The police came over, asked us again whether we would release from the barrel. We said no, we're gonna stay locked onto this barrel, and we're gonna stay here for as long as we can. And then the fireys went about getting their equipment together to attempt to dismantle the barrel and remove us from the barrel. So that involved, I guess, angle grinders and jackhammers. So they sort of,
did quite a good job.
I don't know who made the barrel, but it was pretty well constructed, and plenty of diverse materials in there that were pretty challenging for the firefighters to cut through.
That's good. You gave them a run for their money.
Yeah. Yeah, we got some compliments on the barrels from the Fire East.
I think it's really interesting because the Fireys and the Coppers are being used basically as political tools, and it's an interesting way of politicising them as well, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, I think for sure. The I've noticed on each occasion that we've done these actions. This is the third one now that our group has done, and we've had on previous occasions we've had Fireys and ambulance services as well as the police. And we've had Northern Territory police as well as federal police from the base. And there's a very different response to our actions from like the Fireys and the ambulance services than there is from the police. and my sense is that the ambulance services in particular are very sympathetic to what we're doing. And the Fireys are also...
I mean, firstly, like, congratulations for being really creative and bringing boats out to the middle of the desert and showing solidarity in an actually kind of remarkable way. It blends the symbolic and the actual direct action really quite well. But for people that might not know, who've maybe been living under a rock, what is Pine Gap? Why are you guys out there?
Yeah, so Pine Gap is a surveillance base jointly run by the US and Australian spy agencies. It's widely considered to be the most important US spy base outside of the US, the most important intelligence gathering facility. And it's located sort of in amongst a range 20 kilometers south of Alice Springs. There's about 1,000 people employed at the base. About half of them work for US or Australian government agencies. The other half work for these big military contractors like Raytheon, Amentum, Boeing, other companies. And Pine Gap controls 4 Orion satellites that orbit the Earth and just suck up enormous amounts of communications information, and that information is then processed at the Pine Gap facility, and the US National Security Agency, which operates out of Pine Gap, has at least 8 intelligence sharing agreements with Israel. The CIA signed a new intelligence sharing agreement with Israel after October 7, 2023, and we've got former Pine Gap employees on record as saying that, yes, Pine Gap in this moment would be sharing intelligence with Israel that enables Israel to commit the genocide in Gaza. And that would be both information that's been processed at Pine Gap and that identifies specific targets, but also just raw information that they've sucked up from the Palestinian territories and hand it over to the Israelis to process.
It's our very own little bit of US on Australian soil. It's also a big target for any Australia's open to... It makes us an open target to any people that are our enemies.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. It was that's been a big part of the historic resistance to that base was that it makes us a nuclear target. And during the Cold War, that was a huge concern. And now we're sort of in this new age of nuclear Cold War. And I think it's again, yes. Yeah, the concern about it being military and nuclear targets sort of slipped away for a while, and it's very much back again now.
One of the things about your demonstration really highlights something for me. There's this sense that, say, the Israelis, the Americans, the empire, gives the impression that its power is limitless. But actually, you've got this little base that is really punching above its weight in the in an isolated part of Australia. Well, not isolated from you guys, but from us it is. But it's a fragile network, isn't it, really? I mean, if it was knocked out, all their power goes down the drain.
Yeah. And, it's kind of amazing that all it takes is a small group of people who are prepared to take some action, and a concrete barrel is one road leading into the facility, and if you put a barrel in the road and attach a couple of people to it, you're able to stop work at the facility for the day.
Will any changes be charges being brought against you?
Yes, me and my co-locker honorer, Yul, we've both been charged with refusing to cease to loiter.
Oh, more strength to your arm, Jürgen, and thank you very much for coming on the program this morning.
And be sure we'll reach out and any updates you have, you'll have an Let open line know. With us.
Yeah, right. Yep, we'll definitely keep you in the loop.
Thanks, mate. Bye.
Thanks so much. Take care.
Tourists stumble down Broadway, Cumberland keeps claiming bodies. All our best memories were bought and then turned into apartments. The club with all the hardcore shows, now just a grayscale dominoes. The churches overflow each Sunday, greedy Sunday morning. Underneath the biggest bridges, they pose in Christmas cards with guns as big as all the children. They say that Jesus is the way, but then they gave him a white face, so they don't have to pray to someone they deem lesser than them. The South will not rise again till it's paid for every sin.
And you're back with Annie and Tobiah on Solidarity Breakfast. And we're going to finish up the program with just a little excerpt from the Australian Institute event hosting around A Submarine Dreams, it was called. It hosted Arthur Rorris, who's Secretary of the South Coast Trades and Labour Council, and Doug Cameron, who, former Senator for New South Wales, who's now being branded by the mainstream media as a firebrand Labour man against AUKUS. But anyway, the whole of this particular event is worth listening to, and so I'll put the link on the podcast, but of course it's an Australian Institute event, so you can go to their website and you can listen to the whole webinar, but this is just a little excerpt.
And you'll be able to find all the songs that we shared and all the information about everything on the podcast. That song you just heard was Hayley Williams from Paramore. The song's called True Believer.
This is pretty grim, and it keeps getting grimmer. We saw, I think, last week what may well be a watershed moment for American democracy when the Secretary of Defense, Peter Hegseth, and the President of the United States, Donald Trump, stood up in front of 800 or so members of the top brass of the US military and effectively told them that members of the Defense Force could retaliate without consequences, that they could use cities like Chicago or Portland or Los Angeles as training grounds, and that they were effectively unconstrained by morality and would become, or could become, effectively an instrument of the Oval Office. I was reading in the Atlantic's daily newsletter today, Tom Nichols, who's not exactly a radical, wrote that soon top US military commanders may have to decide whether they will refuse such orders, illegal orders, from the commander-in-chief. The greatest crisis of American civil-military relations in modern history is now underway. So this is how serious things are. And of course, this has potentially severe consequences for American democracy, but it has very real consequences for the rest of the world too, as none of this is confined to the domestic United States. All of this is being projected outwards as the Trump administration deliberately dismantles the international rule of law and institutions of global governance. And the question then becomes, of course, what does this mean for the rest of the world? What does it mean in particular for traditional allies of the United States, like Australia? What does it mean if the American military becomes an instrument of the White House, unconstrained by morality or democratic accountability? And why is it that the Australian government seems to be doubling down on the alliance? And how has the alliance, given all that is unfolding in the United States, given that the world order is being remade as we watch, how is it that the alliance has become so focused only on submarines? And this despite increasing evidence that the AUKUS nuclear-powered submarine pact is destined to fall over. And yet the Australian Labor government appears to remain pretty committed to this deal. And that's in the face, I think, of rising community concern. You know, polling by the Australia Institute indicates that the Australian community is not convinced. 54% of Australians now say they want a more independent foreign policy. Nearly 57% support or strongly support a parliamentary inquiry into the AUKUS submarine deal. So, where to now? Where do we go with all of this? Joining me today to discuss these questions and more are, as you can see on the screen, the Honourable Doug Cameron, the former Senator from New South Wales from 2007 to 2019, representing the Australian Labor Party. Doug served as Parliamentary Secretary for Housing and Homelessness in the second Rudd government, and then was opposition shadow minister across the portfolios of Human Services, Skills, TAFE and Apprenticeships, and Housing and Homelessness. Doug retired from Parliament in 2019, but has stayed very active in Australian public life, championing progressive causes, including housing policy reform and the need for foreign policy independence. Arthur Rorris, who is joining us from Crete to explain the darkness there very kindly, all the way from Crete, is the Secretary of the New South Wales South Coast Trades and Labour Council, which is a peak union body representing 25 affiliated unions from the Illawarra all the way to the Victorian border in the south. And in his role as Secretary, he has been a leading campaigner for green jobs, for climate action, for a nuclear-free future, and the Labour movement against AUKUS. Okay, so with all that, let's get stuck in. Doug, I thought I'd begin with you. We've heard news in the last couple of weeks that AUKUS will likely survive the Trump review, although it has gone on a lot longer than promised, and that will likely be formally announced around the time of that much-anticipated meeting between Prime Minister Albanese and President Trump. What do you make of it all? Were you surprised by this review?
No, absolutely not. I took the view that when you've got a mug, hold on to them. And Australia has just signed agreements that are terrible. They destroy our sovereignty. They make us nothing more than, you know, a part of the US global position. I never had any doubt that AUKUS would be cancelled. I just thought it was too good a deal for the US to walk away from this.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. And you mentioned there, Doug, the question of sovereignty. Richard Miles, the defence minister, has argued a number of times, I think, that AUKUS actually enhances Australian sovereignty. But I'm guessing from your comments there that that's not how you see it. What impact do you think that AUKUS does have on Australian sovereignty?
Well, it destroys our sovereignty. We have allowed the biggest military power in the world to set up a base or a number of bases in Australia. We had a long, proud tradition of opposing nuclear arms. We will now have nuclear submarines that are US with nuclear arms on board. We will have, B-52 bombers, strike bombers capable of striking against China on our shores with nuclear arms. So how can this enhance our sovereignty? It's the most bizarre argument I've ever heard from any politician for a long time. You just cannot keep denying reality. A bad deal that we've signed, we lose our sovereignty, and we become nothing more than an appendage of US militarism.
Arthur, I think, the polling I mentioned earlier suggests that the community is at odds somewhat with the government position on this. That community concern mirrors the concerns that Doug just outlined. You've been working on the ground in your community a lot around AUKUS in particular. Is that what you're seeing in your community, a level of concern about this?
Well, very much so. I mean, this is a campaign in which the uni movement's playing a very big and leading role. But only recently there was a declaration from Port Kembla, from our key port in our area, signed by 41 community organisations, that was instigated by those community organisations. It's showing that the people, again, are ahead of the government when it comes to those very real concerns. And those concerns extend across a range of areas. I mean, this is, in many ways, people see this as something that is unlikely to happen in the way that the governments project it to happen, but believe that it's even worse if it works. This is one of those few things where it's unlikely to ever work, but it'll actually be worse if it does. So it puts us into a no-win situation, but it focuses the mind of the community on what happens on the ground. We hear the big picture strategic arguments about China and other things. The purpose has never been clear. It's more creep than mission, as we say, when you look at people like Trump and others. And people ask the question, well, what is it all for? What will it mean for my community? Is it as bad as just becoming nuclear targets? Is there more to it? Will we have access to our own land? Because we see what happens in other areas. The one big thing now, I guess, is the thing that's really hit home is the events in the US, because people can see through this. Behind every government suggestion of, well, we play the long game, not just administration by administration, implying that Trump will go and then we'll return to normality. I think now, for the first time, people are starting to have real doubts as to what the real normal is, whether it has changed forever, and what happens if we're basically put into a compromised position during a Trump administration, given that he's now not even talking about defense, he's talking about offense. He's even renamed his department, the Department of War. What does that mean for his strategic partners? And at the end of the day, the ultimate thing, I think the killer, really, for pardon the pun, for our community, was seeing what's happening in Europe with the Ukraine. And people are asking themselves the question, if he's not really going to lift a finger for Europe, what's he going to do for Australia or Port Kembla? You know, so people feel as if these decisions are made in secrecy, without explanation, and without any realistic, no real attempt to actually explain what the purpose of this is.
But there are a few questions in the chat about the...
Yeah, and so...
There's a few questions in the chat everywhere, because even the war in Ukraine, I mean... It's a conflict that just happens in the background, but there's reportedly there's a million active fighters on both sides.
Mad.
And over a million people dead in that war.
And all that's happening is that big corporation, arms corporations, are making a zillion dollars out of an endless war. It's just, I mean, it's at this point that you go, excuse the French, but... Anyway, we've finished the program. We can't do anything more. We're just ropeable. We're yelling it at our computers. But we do have some events to tell you about. At 9:30 down at the Dockland Library, if you're in a position to go, there's an injured workers event going on. It's going on for the whole day. Injured workers are going to be speaking up, and there's going to be other people, because there's quite a few changes in legislation in regards to how injured workers are going to be assessed and their futures. So if you want to go down there and have a listen to some of the speakers, that would be good. There's also going to be a Venezuelan rally a gathering at 11 outside the State Library, and to people going to be speaking up about some of the things that are happening, the threats to Venezuela.
And tomorrow, obviously, come down, the National Day of Action for Palestine, 12 State Library. Be there. Also on the 23rd of...
Oh, and be careful that you might get caught up with the marathon runners.
A lot of events going on. It's going to be a marathon for us as well. The 23rd of October at 6 p.m, that's the Thursday at 11:13 at 113 Swanson Street, there will be a public housing meeting at the Capitol Theatre.
A speak up.
And then on the 24th of October, Phil F. is showing Five Broken Cameras at Democritus Workers League. That's 583 High Street, Northcote. Entry by donation. We're raising funds for Olive Kids. And also, if you go on the NIBS website, we're also, in conjunction with NIBS and the Search Foundation, we're presenting the first inaugural Gaetano Greco Memorial Symposium on Gramsci's relevance, contemporary relevance. That's 6:30 p.m. on the 11th of November. That's it for us. We'll go out.
On November the 11th, you can also go to the steps of Parliament at 12 with Dr. Joe and his crew to commemorate the fall of Whitlam.
Beautiful. And that's all for us. We've got, we'll go out with a song by 99 Passe and Salti Frontali. This is a song that was heard through all the rallies in Italy. It's called Fino all'ultimo respiro, which is till the last breath. And it's encouraging you to go out and get there and do as much as you can.
And stand with us. Coming up next is Asia Pacific Currents. Now you spark a speech.
Le mattine,
dai e spacca, spingi.
Fa già meglio, ma tu insisti.
Spingi.
Non c'hai altre alternative.
Free, free, Palestine.
Come?
Free, free.
Agli assassini per dormire ora serve il fentanyl, perché i morti tornano di notte come Fedain. È un po' tardi adesso per godere dei tuoi sogni, occupante nazi della casa che era dei suoi nonni. Rivoluzionario questo tempo, sparo dopo sparo, l'hai capito da che parte stare, è tutto più chiaro. Bambini in fila per il cibo fatti a pezzi, giornalisti uccisi per gridare al mondo siete mostri. Per la terra, per la libertà, per il ritorno, per la Palestina libera com'era un giorno. I miei boss sono all'attacco per forzare il blocco, anch'io sono in cammino altrimenti sbrocco. E questa flotta va, questa lotta fa venire il desiderio di averla anche per noi la libertà, prendetela sul serio. Non saremo mai zitti e indifferenti, a vedervi nelle strade siete commoventi.
Non vi lasceremo mai, fino all'ultimo respiro noi saremo insieme a voi come un sole che risplende. Alto sulle piazze fra le vostre tende.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.